you have to really question whether this person was really competent to be doing what he was doing. And I've also had to deal with situations where they're using power of attorneys for somebody that's dead. Once the person dies, the power of attorney dies with them. And so we have to be extremely cautious nowadays because of what's going on out there. I've had this, recently, we had a situation where a lady had granted to her church pastor. They granted to either secretary or somebody in order to get a new loan. Well, they got a new loan, and she was able to pay off the old one, and the new one was at a better rate and all that. But they didn't grant the property back to her. And the person who had control of it went out and got a new loan, a second loan. And that person kept all the money. And so eventually that went into default, ended up in court, and it was quite a mess. Now the lady, who was originally owned the property, she was in a really tough position because she really did grant the property to this person. And this person really did have the power, or at least the title, in order to go get a loan from the lender. And the lender was innocent. They checked out the person's financials and they went ahead and made the loan to them. And so in cases like that, we as a title company don't have a lot of liability because the grant initially was okay, but we don't want to be involved in anything like that. And if we spot that happening, we're canceling that order. There's also situations where we have, identity theft, where they take the name of someone and they have them buy a property, and then they lease out the property, take the payments from them, and then the thing will go into foreclosure, and the person will lose property that they actually never even owned. What happens is that destroys their credit. And so they didn't know about what was going on until after the foreclosure. And then they try to get a loan on their own property, and they find out their credit's destroyed. And it takes them a long time to clean those things up. We also have situations where in our escrow departments, they're getting really crafty out there as far as trying to, just scam money. One of the things, we had one several months ago where one of my escrow officers called me up and said, now this looks fun. And what it was, there was a sale and someone put in an offer on a property that was accepted. And they put in, their deposit. It was a very high deposit. It was a Montecito property. Then after a while, a very short while, they contacted the escrow and said, well, we need some of that money back because my wife needs to use it for something or other. And the contract really only required, say, a $200,000 deposit rather than a $250,000. So we need you to send $50,000 back. Well, that's when I got the call from escrow. And so we started investigating, and then it was looking worse and worse. And what it is they put deposits into escrow, put a check. If it's a personal check, they have to wait. It has to clear. Well, they're trying to get you to issue a title company check back to them for the $50,000, because the $250,000 was no good to begin with. But that title check's good as gold. And so so I started tracking down the reported attorney for them and whatnot, and then no callbacks. And so we just waited it out and waited for those checks to bounce, and they did. So that type of thing is rather unusual for Santa Barbara. It happens a lot more down in Ventura, in LA, and in larger areas. But it is, unfortunately, fairly common, and we are always on the lookout for that type of thing. The other problems we get into is the payoff of old equity loans, they're called HELOCs, and I forgot what that stands for. But we'll get a demand, we'll pay it off, and there's a procedure that you have the people sign, where they tell you to close the account. If you don't have them sign and close the account, well, they go back in there and they start borrowing more money. But the deed of trust is still on record, and it's superior to the, as far as the record goes, to the one that you just put on and insured. And they got a zero demand on it when they close it. Afterwards, people start taking money out on that old HELOC, and all of a sudden we find out that we have $100,000 deed of trust that should have been closed out. And those things are quite a big problem. But with those are just sort of the things that in the title industry we're dealing with that you probably don't even ever think about. You're looking at this, the guys issue the preliminary reports and record the deeds that you call us up and say you have the wrong legal description on there. There's also nowadays too much reliance on such as partial numbers, where people no longer read out legal descriptions, because especially if it's work that's being done overseas, they got to go through these things fast. It's production. Everything's production. So they're going through these things. They see such as parcel number. That one's good, and they put it to that property that goes with that assessment parcel number, though the legal description has nothing to do with it. And so we're, that is a problem that we see. In another area, there's something that we do that nobody really knows about, and that's when we have a title order, or every time we have a title order, we have to run the names in a system that, it's an automated system for us. But what it does is it runs the names for the anybody that would be showing up on the special designated nationals, the SND or SDN list. And in that list is put out by the Office of Foreign Assets Control, and they're looking for money that's funding terrorists that they're hiding through the properties and through transactions, because with property generates large amounts of money, and so it's easy to hide things in there. And so when we do have an order, the names are automatically run. Now, if we do find something, then it goes to this long rigmarole through the company as far as, is it the right person? There's different steps. And then the company will get back to the escrow officer and somebody say, well, this has hit a level two. So essentially you can't do anything as far as progressing to close that title order. And if it's if we do close it, it's very dangerous, because it's a criminal act to generate money to any one of these parties that are on this list, whether you do it purposely or not. All you have to do is be involved in having that go forward, and you now have a criminal act. And I think it's $10,000 to, you know, to $10 million penalty, and then I think some jail time involved in that. So we're pretty careful about that. But if we do find somebody, it's also a criminal act for us to tell them that, hey, your name came up on this list. So we got to slow down the order somehow, and, you know, wait for the company to do whatever it is they're doing with, you know, the federal government, is in being able to release that order to close. Actually, we've never to locally come across anybody who was a real bad guy. But it's not just the, you know, the terrorist situation, it's also the drug. If anybody is involved in drugs and the government knows it, has their name on that list, then, you know, that's that will show up just like it was, you know, a terrorist bad guy. So we, you know, we're very careful with that. Now, I was looking up on where the government had the authority to do that, and I found it rather interesting that the government first exercised its power back in the War of 1812. And around that time, the British would stop American ships at sea. And because it was so hard for the British to get people to man their ships, they stopped the American ships, grabbed the people off of it, and put them into service in the British Navy. And so the U.S. government came up with a sanction program against the British government. And in the Civil War, they had a similar situation, but it was against the Confederacy. And, you know, it's always been, you know, under the Department of Treasury. Over time, the government imposed these sanctions, and in many ways, and in, by various controlling agencies that would come up underneath the Treasury Department, the office of the Office of Foreign Asset Control is currently under the Treasury, and that one came about during the Korean War. And so it's taking different names, different forms, but does, you know, the same thing. But now they have a lot more clout, and I know that Fidelity Title got nailed for some fines because of this, you know, this law, and if someone had been unknowingly dealing with someone who's on this list. But Fidelity got nailed because they bought a company, another title company, who was in violation. So they bought this other company, and because they owned it, by the time that the government figured it out, they got nailed for the fines. So as far as I know, we've been pretty clean on those situations. But it is one of those things that nobody really knows that we have to do, because if we do find it, we can't tell you. The list is a very lengthy list, and unfortunately there's a lot of times where there's people with rather common names on there, and you'll run the list, you'll get a hit back saying that, you know, hold up, you better check this out because it's a level 2 situation, and that's and then it takes a while for them to filter it out. You just keep asking for more information, and, you know, your customer is asking, well, what do you need this information? Oh, my God. You still need to give us that information. So, So that's just one of those little things that cost us a lot of time and we have to do anyway. One other thing is nowadays, because the credit is so tight that we have to really, really crunch down on areas of construction loans, where before we were able to move through those pretty quickly, we'd get indemnities and financial statements from people. But during this rather large turndown in the market, there's a lot of things that went belly up. And the title company insured construction loans. And these construction loans sometimes had what's called broken priority. Now, broken priority is sort of an interesting situation in that there's work started on the property before the loan goes of record. Now, if work is started on the property in furtherance of the development, all the lien claimants, both present or currently and in the future, take a prior position to the new loan that just went on. So the way that it's supposed to happen is that the new loan goes on first before anything is touched on the property. And I mean anything touched on the property. If any work is started, and it could be the most minimal work, then you have a situation where the guy who's putting on the gutters for the roof at the very end, his lien claim jumps up in front of the loan. Well, when things were going along pretty well in the business, then we look at the indemnities, we'd look at the financials, and if everything looked good, that they could cover any reasonable overruns on the project, then we'd go ahead and insure this new lender and protect them from any mechanics liens situations that come in afterwards. When this downturn in the market happened, all these financials really became worthless as far as reflecting what the value of the strength of the developer was at the time. And the company lost millions and millions of dollars to the point where they took all the authority away from local underwriters. I used to have, at one point, locally, say, $10 million authority. It got cranked down to zero. Everything would have to go to higher ups. And then eventually, if it was over a certain amount, which I think was over $2 million, it would actually have to go back to Jacksonville, Florida to be approved. So with that situation, we have a lot of problems with work that's been started, and where we were able to just to deal with it before. Now it's very, very hard. We had one not too long ago that was a $45 million project. Well, they went out and started. No one checked with us. We would put in the don't start. Well, for one of that magnitude, the scrutiny that it took was probably a month and a half of scrutiny. And trying to sell the main underwriter who had the authority to approve such a risk that it was a good risk. Eventually, we did do it, but we didn't do it in the manner that it used to be done, where it was just a simple indemnity. There was a lot more layers involved as far as of getting protection from owners in guarantors of the project. Guarantors are those parties of the bank should require to, when they look at everything, that, well, you need, your personal financials are not strong enough. We need someone else in there to also guarantee that. So we would have them also join in on the indemnification for us. Now, the situation is that we have to look at those financials in a harsher manner than the bank does, because the bank has their deed of trust out there to help them, you know, give them security on the loan, and they also have the title company there as a buffer to protect them for that loan. The title company just has this little indemnity paper that we don't have a deed of trust. You know, if things go belly up, we have to go protect our insurer, our lender, and protect them against the mechanics liens, protect them against anything else that happens to come up that has asserted a priority interest. So with that, the underwriting on those has gotten really very, very stringent. And I really think that, you know, over time that'll probably loosen up somewhat, but not a whole lot. I have a certain amount of authority again as a local underwriter. It's not very big. It's good enough for, you know, some of the local houses or improvements, remodels and things that people do. But, you know, there's anything over $500,000 of hard costs, you know, it has to wind up the ladder. And so that's been a big change in the business, is that we've had to tighten things down. Now with with a lot of what is done now is the, you know off those type of stories. Back more under the title end, Perry Reddy was talking about the legal descriptions and, you know, how they work and how they come down chronologically. Where, you know, your best legal description is your strongest one is your rancho. Ranchos take precedent over everything else. Government comes in, does the government section land surveys, and they go up to the edge of the rancho. There's areas here in this county where there's a little section of area in between two ranchos that's really, really a small sliver. Well, you know, there's little section lines in there because that comes under the government surveys. And sometimes those little areas give us a little bit of problems because the rancho descriptions weren't all that good. Even though they take a lot more time to do, is the legal descriptions that just tie to other people's deeds. Because we have, you know, in that case, the deeds that are first in time. First in time are going to take precedent, and, you know, to whatever comes next. And there's there's times where I've had the the title search just of when you type in the legal description of our report. I go, well, you know, take out those calls. You know, there's a call going down 400 feet to a monument, but you know there's only 200 feet there at best. And that 400 feet is going to bow to the tide, to the monument. And some people don't agree with doing that, but if it's so ridiculous, and, you know, we had those problems along the coast too, you know, 400 feet down to the mean tide line, or mean tide line, and there's areas, especially along in the Carpentaria area, where they say that due to where they put the breakwater, they redid the current, and so they started, you have areas where there used to be land when they first did their surveys, but, I mean, hundreds of feet are gone. They're out in the ocean. And the legal descriptions will still call out, you know, 400 feet to a certain point, but that point is long gone. And sometimes in certain areas of Carpentaria, it really is just a sliver of land that's left. I was working with one where the sliver of land was the area between the beach and the railroad tracks. And there wasn't very much there. But if you read the legal description, it looked pretty big. Go down to the property, you can't figure it out. You know, here's the railroad tracks, there's the ocean, there's 400 feet, and it's not there. And so there's certain things that we do, you know, in doing tiles that we, you know, we don't like to mess around with the legal descriptions. You know, if they're a record, and they're relatively correct. And there's slight discrepancies in there, but ones that we can live with because we know that there's tie points in there. And there's also in the CLTA policies, there's an exclusion from coverage, and that's the exclusion which provides that we don't cover anything that a correct survey would show. Because the correct survey, if there's never been a survey done on the property, there's nothing recorded, there's nothing we can go to, and we're not surveyors. You know, we are dealing with a record title. And I'm sure with what you do, you've come across that many, many times where you're looking at it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's also areas in the city of Santa Barbara and Don Ireland's favorite areas of city blocks where the legal descriptions didn't talk. You know, they start from one corner, then they'll start from another corner. The blocks were supposed to be 450 feet square. A lot of them are, you know, one side might be 453, the other one might be 450, and it creates all these little gaps. Well, these gaps that are owned by the person who last owned the entire block, which is, you know, back in the 1800s sometime. And people will be asking us to ensure the ownership of that, of these little strips of land. And we can't, not until there's a quiet title action. Now, the quiet title action sometimes gets a little bit tricky. If the parcel doesn't have a assessor's parcel number, where someone can say that they paid the taxes on it, well, that's one of the requirements of adverse possession. If you can't prove that you paid the taxes, well, then you can get a prescriptive easement for whatever your uses have been. If you can prove that the tax has been paid, and I've recently, in the last 5 years, have had a couple of things where up in the range lands, up in the Saranac Valley, where someone was clever enough to figure out how the legal description read in this one area, which looked minuscule on the maps because of the scale of the maps, was still in the name of the old owner from down below, but it was taxed and occupied by the guy up above. And it was probably like a 3 or 4 acre parcel of land. And there was an attorney who was, you know, one of the owners of the piece down below. And once he got the information, well, yeah, your legal description does include that, and but you have not possessed it. And the guys above have been paying the taxes on it all these years. The guy just backed down and said, all right, you know, I'm not gonna fight you on it, because, you know, it just costs me a lot of money, I lose. Because that's one of the elements that we almost always don't have, and that is the payment of the taxes. And the taxes are usually, they're going to rely on the assessor's parcel map. Was that little piece included, you know, in one of these parcels? Who was paying for that over those years? I have one that I was dealing with a couple of weeks ago. It was a situation where the city had widened the street, and so it was conveyed to them. You know, it was, I think, 2.3 feet wide. Then the city decided they didn't want it anymore, so they conveyed it back to the guy. Well, that created this 2.3 feet where it showed up being put like in the middle of the properties, and some guys, you know, would have this little extra strip, other ones wouldn't, or it'd be the strip that would attach to the guy on top, but in other times it was attached to the guy in the bottom. And the one I was working with, the guy came in, he goes, you know, why is there this jog in my property? And we looked at it and we go, well, I don't know. No deed for it. He goes, yeah, well, he goes, it's, you know, it's part of my tax parcel. I've been paying the taxes on that for all these years. I'd like to have it, but the lady down below is the one who's fenced it. She's been, you know, using it for forever. So he's been paying the taxes on it. She had possession of it. And, well, we're going to have a little trouble on adverse possession situation. It's, you're missing your, you know, the main element that you... one of the main elements, which was the possession. He had the taxes, which is usually the one that you're missing. And so you finally decide, you know, I don't want it. And so I think he's going to be getting in touch with Blaine pretty soon about this little piece of property that, you know, he doesn't want to have anything to do with. He doesn't want the liability of it, because of it showing on as part of his parcel, knows that he can't get ownership of it, and so he really just doesn't want it. It's been like that for forever, and you know, it took a while for anybody to, you know, to really question it. So anyway, that's pretty much all I really had to say today. Did anyone have any questions on legal descriptions, on anything else? Yes, sure.
One tangible subject we have in L.A., when the tax maps are recorded, and they originally cover two parcels, they're comprised of two different entities, two different owners, and they get together and file a tract map. Now, that tract map is insured by a title company, which is good, because the overall boundaries are owned by A and B. However, it cuts up the lots now into 14 different lots, which some of them are completely in A, some of them are in B, and some of them are half-half. Mm-hmm. Now, public works people, I might be noticing that and should be working on deeds right away to clean up the title. Mm-hmm. Do you think title officers who notice this should be calling on the client right away before the recordation of the track and tell them, watch out, there's a problem here?
I think so. You know that's a situation where you said that there's a track map that's put on by two individuals, one owning, say, the east half, one owning the west half. They put on the map, then the map subdivides everything. I've had that situation before. And what I required is, when there was a deed out, that it it goes on. Because there's, you know, I've had other times where they, between themselves, and said, okay, you get, you know, these parcels, and I get these parcels, and they quit-claim each other. But usually, because they both show as subdividers, I would make them both sign an deed going out, and maybe see some R's, anything like that, and not depend on, well, this one's on the west half of the situation. I just don't think that would be a reasonable way of doing it.
You keep the multiple APN until the new owner bought it?
We used to try to be as nice as possible to taxpayers. And finally, 2 years ago, I got tired of it. And I said, cut it. We have the subdivision right back. I cut it. The original parcel lines work.
Yeah.
And if the new lots are being cut, you know, portion of the lot here, portion of that here, I kept it separate.
That's what I actually wrote about 3 years ago.
Question. I used to review
traffic
parcel lines. At what point does the
does not change the ownership.
Right, but if two parcels in essence are combined into one.
You cannot combine them, that's a change of ownership. And in our terminology, that's an appraisal event.
Right, it's a reappraisal event.
But it's not
a proportional interest in the overall rather than.
No.
As you tell about it,
he can tell you as a tell guy.
It really doesn't change title, but it does create a situation in my mind that I have to deal with it as if they both own all the lots. And, you know, there's going to be dedications involved. It's going to be, they're normally going to be treating that as one subdivision with one set of CC&Rs usually. And so, if for all intents and purposes they're treating it as one subdivision owned by two parties, that's how I treat it. And nothing gets conveyed out or insured until they come to terms with that. If they do want to you know, split the baby in half and you know one gets these lots and one gets the other, that's fine. But I won't take a deed from just the one. Yeah.
We had a discussion about the law, I guess in previous speaker. Okay, it's a situation where by lot line adjustment, parcel had been adjusted, but just because of the ownership, it remains and we give a new parcel number and do not manage it. So the owner tries to sell all the parcels separately. So how do you
I'm not sure I understood what you said on
that. There are two parcels, right?
There are two parcels.
And then by lot line adjustment, it's adjusted. And just because of the ownership, we create three parcels. And we have one parcel has to be transferred by deed before it can be met. And that has not happened.
You created parcels or a lot line adjustment without a deed transfer?
Yes.
Yeah. How do you create three parcels out of two?
You don't have to exchange these.
So I wish I arrived at a situation there. The owner, one of the owners, the appropriate for closing, he bought as three parcels. It should have been only two parcels.
Should have been two parcels. You can't do it. Get a third parcel out of a lot line adjustment of two parcels.
But the situation remains as three parcels. And then the buyer who buys, he sees that it is three parcels. And then now, when he wants to sell it, then the one title company made it into three parcels and sold it to the owner and the real estate person. And when he wants to sell, then he goes to another title company and says, no, if I legal, it should be only two parcels.
I agree with that. It should be two parcels.
It should be two parcels.
And I wouldn't insure any of them.
Yeah.
Not until they got it fixed.
Okay.
Okay.
there should be. Yes.
Yeah. You can.
No.
Okay. Question. I grew up with you. I started with Guy Corps in 1971. Your good friend John Flood and Bob Rayburn and all those mm-hmm. guys. And in those days, we got a great education. And they sent us to class, ATO classes and all of that. But the one thing they really stressed was to get fixed right. Nowadays, title companies are different. And while you're going through problems like they're discussing right here, what is the assessor's office supposed to do with the problem? I got change of title going this direction, I got change of title going that direction, merely because it takes so long for the title company to, let's just say, get motivated enough to fix them. Any suggestions?
That is a problem. That really is a problem. And part of this is the problem is that they aren't staffed like they used to be.
Yes.
You know, when I was at first at Title Insurance and Trust back in the day, the word was claims are not a problem because we're not going to have any.
Right.
And you just worse. I mean, you just you started on a project, and like the third project I had for as a long order searcher. And I became a long order searcher because I've been doing all the other things, and nobody wanted the job. And so I graduated from UCSB, and they go, well, what are you going to be doing? I haven't decided yet. Do you want to be a long order searcher? And I go, well, I haven't got the job. So sure. The third search they gave me was the San Jacinto Indian Reservation. And I go, well, this doesn't look very good. It took me a long time to get through that one. I learned a lot on that particular one. But that is a real big problem now because they're, like I said earlier on, I'm not teaching, the young kids coming up the ranks. There are no young kids coming up the ranks, at least locally. And so you'll have to deal with, where are your assessors, where do you work?
Northern Center, Yuba County.
But, oh.
Northern California.
Yeah, well, and that's a... That's the problem I hear about quite a bit. And there's, and I don't have a good suggestion for you. Find an underwriter who will back you up and try to light a fire under somebody.
With Fidelity, I can get a hold of Chuck Whitecott.
Yeah.
And of course, that's my answer as well, is that when I have a title officer that they don't want to fix a problem, I call Alan.
but unfortunately, your name appears on my phone.
Yeah, that's the problem with a new phone. We better hurry.
So that's about it, I guess. We're out of time.
Thank you.